Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated. Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, why we think we're getting good healthcare and why we're usually wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Hi, folks. Welcome to New Books in Medicine. I'm your host, Dana Greenfield, a medical student at UC San Francisco. Today on the show, I'll be speaking with Mara Bookbinder about her new book, All in Your Head, Making Sense of Pediatric Pain. Professor Bookbinder holds a master's in anthropology from Case Western and a PhD in anthropology from UCLA. Now she's an associate professor of social medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. She's also affiliated with the Department of Anthropology and the UNC Center for Bioethics. Her first book was entitled Saving Babies, The Consequences of Newborn Genetic Screening, co-authored with Stefan Timmermans. She's also co-edited a volume called Understanding Health Inequalities and Justice, Bridging Perspectives for New Conversations with Michelle Rifkin-Fish and Rebecca Walker. Today, though, we're talking about her new book on the management of chronic pediatric pain. I really enjoyed my conversation with her, and I hope you enjoyed as well. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine. I'm Dana Greenfield, the host of the channel. Today, we're talking with Mara Bookbinder. She's Associate Professor of Social Medicine and affiliated with the Anthropology Department at UNC in Chapel Hill. And her new book is called All in Your Head, Making Sense of Pediatric Pain. So glad to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dana. I'm glad to be here.
So I was wondering if we could start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself. And I'd like to get a sense of what brought you to the field of anthropology.
Sure. So I guess I had kind of a slightly roundabout way of coming to anthropology. I did not study anthropology at all in college until my senior year. I had been a psychology major and was very interested in health psychology. Actually, primarily because I have a chronic illness myself and worked in a mentoring program while I was an undergraduate student that paired college students with chronic illnesses with youth in the area, adolescents in the area that had similar health conditions. So I really wanted to study how adolescents dealt with chronic illness and ended up putting together kind of an interdisciplinary senior honors thesis where I got exposed to medical anthropology and kind of fell in love with it.
I feel like I hear that a lot from my friends who are in anthropology, this idea of like falling in love with it. And I'm wondering for you, what did that mean?
I really liked the idea that stories could be data. What initially drew me to medical anthropology was kind of the illness narrative framework that came out of work that Arthur Kleinman and others had done in the 1980s. And I wanted to explore that more. I really liked the idea that my research could be based on kind of asking people to tell me their stories about illness experience. And at the time, I was actually using a visual illness narrative approach. So my thesis project was interdisciplinary because I was having adolescents make video illness narratives or video diaries about living with type 1 diabetes. And I just really liked the tools that anthropology gave me for thinking about that and for thinking about the value that stories can bring to understandings of illness experience.
Yeah, I think I totally resonate with that myself. And I know that this pain project wasn't the only one that you began with. Previously, you were telling me that you were doing this work at the same time as working on genetic testing in newborns. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how you came to pain as a topic and how that related to this work that you were doing at the exact same time on something that's seemingly unrelated.
Yeah, I came to the topic because really for pragmatic reasons, to be honest, there was a large scale study that was going on or sort of wrapping up in the clinic that I ended up doing my dissertation research in. And the director, whom I call Dr. Novak in the book, was just really open to the idea of ethnographic research. And I was kind of looking for a pediatric clinical setting where I could do long-term ethnographic work and became really excited about the idea of looking at chronic pain because it just seemed so rich and also so poorly understood. And it seemed to be an area where a social or a cultural lens could still add a lot to the literature. And then the other project was some work that I was doing as a graduate research assistant at the same time, looking at the expansion of newborn screening. And so I was actually doing field work in a metabolic genetics clinic in the very same hospital. And it was atypical, I suppose, to do it that way, because most anthropology graduate students, when they're doing their dissertation research, they're really completely immersed in that and only doing that. And I actually found it valuable to be collecting data for both projects at the same time because they sort of provided me with these built-in comparative reference points. So I could kind of think about how language was being used in both clinics or, how the clinics were both structured. And one of the things that was really helpful in shaping my understanding of the West Clinic, which is the pseudonym that I give the pain clinic, is that I knew from very early on that the clinic served a very affluent, very privileged population. But working at the same time in a clinic that had a much broader range of socioeconomic diversity really brought that home for me and helped me to kind of think about what that meant, what it meant that the West Clinic would only take patients that that had private insurance and that kind of thing, and like what the consequences were for thinking about how the treatment models developed and how patients experienced the care that they received. And I think that I would have gotten there eventually had I not been working in the genetics clinic at the same time. But I think I made some of those connections more quickly and more easily because I was able to look at the two clinics alongside each other.
Yeah. And I think another thing that I'm sorry, Mara, I'm getting a lot of feedback on your end. I'll ask them to just edit out this comment, but I'm no longer hearing it. Okay. So another thing that makes me think about the two clinics, that is that they're both very much dependent on families, or the family, I should say, like, clearly plays a large role. I mean, it does in pediatrics, but I mean, for sure within a genetic setting, as well as the pain setting. And I'm wondering if they taught you different things about the role of families.
Yes. I mean, I think that in any pediatric setting, that's probably going to be the case. I would say the role of the parents was quite different in each setting, because in the genetics clinic, I was, the patients were mostly nonverbal, right? Because we're talking about newborn screening patients. So these are newborn babies, and the physicians were kind of working exclusively with the parents. Whereas in the pediatric pain clinic, there was this very intricate dance between the physicians and the parents and the patients.
Yeah, and I'd like to get to that once we turn to the book. But I wanted to also ask you, you know, you mentioned that you were excited about the tools of what the tools of anthropology could bring to pain. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit more about what ethnography does for you when you're trying to understand pain.
I think it brings an appreciation for context. I mean, pain, we know kind of from the biopsychosocial model of pain, which is this idea that pain is all of these things. It's biological, it's psychological, and it's social. That pain is not only shaped by individual physiology. And so the social context and the cultural context as well of pain patients really matters. And I think that ethnography can bring a sensitivity to context that can really help to illustrate how context can shape the experience of pain.
So how did you collect your data? What were the sites that you were located in? And how did you decide who to follow and where did you follow them?
Yeah, so the study was fundamentally an ethnography of this particular multidisciplinary pediatric pain clinic. But I really wanted to get out of the clinic as well. So I didn't want to limit myself to the clinic. And the idea was to follow individual patients in their pathways to the clinic, and then in the clinic, and then taking what they learned in the clinic out of the clinic. So I had four patients that I followed longitudinally, interviewed them before their first visit in the clinic, and then video recorded their first appointment in the clinic, and then recorded in some cases additional interactions with other healthcare providers aside from the physician, and then kind of spent time with them in their homes and sort of looked at how the clinic's therapeutic approach made a difference for those particular patients. Then I had another group of patients and families whom I observed in the clinic and maybe interviewed one time, but didn't necessarily follow them longitudinally.
And did you go outside of the clinic to try to understand pain in a more broader sense, like what the field of pain medicine was about?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I went to a couple of conferences, and that comes out in the book as well. I was really interested in kind of being able to situate what was happening in this clinic within kind of a broader landscape of pediatric pain medicine in general. And I traced some of the debates that were happening within the field. And then, you know, I think societally, I taught quite a bit about schools. I didn't do any participant observation inside of schools, but I thought about schools and how the school context mattered for these individual patients and how kind of the achievement orientation of our society mattered for the experience of pain and what happened to patients in the aftermath of a major chronic pain episode.
Hmm. Yeah. And that just made me wonder if there were any places that you, if you had all the time and all the access in the world, if there were places that you wish you could have gone to round out your understanding of pain. Because I feel like, you know, we always see where people went when they did ethnographies, but like behind the scenes, where there's so much brainstorming and work and effort that goes into thinking about where else you could like look and locate pain, because it's almost unlimited. So I was just curious if there were other places that if there was further work in this area that you could have would have done.
I think it would have been great to have more access to some of the therapeutic sessions with the clinicians on the multidisciplinary team. So I was able to observe a couple of those sessions, but many of those providers were fairly protective of the kind of therapeutic space with individual patients for good reason. But I think it would have been helpful for me to see, for example, some of the hypnotherapy sessions or, you know, what a one-on-one art therapy session might look like. I was able to interview the art therapist about some of the patients that she worked with, but I didn't directly observe any of those sessions.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's exciting about anthropology are all these possibilities, but the limits is there's, you can't be in all places all the time. So can you describe the clinic for us a little bit more in detail?
Sure. It was a multidisciplinary pediatric pain clinic that was based within an academic medical center. And then it was sort of unique in the sense that it referred, so every patient that came into the clinic would have an appointment with one of two physicians. There was also a psychiatrist that worked with the team and sometimes saw patients in the clinic, but also saw patients in a private practice located outside of the clinic. And what was unique about the clinic is they had this amazing multidisciplinary team, but the team members were not employed by the medical center. So patients would be referred to these providers, but they all had their own private practices located in various places in the community. So that was one of the reasons why the clinic really privileged patients from more socioeconomic advantage backgrounds, because many of these therapeutic modalities were ones that didn't accept insurance. And so it was private pay. And it also required parents to be doing a lot of driving all over the place. And this is Southern California, so there's a lot of traffic. So it was a unique model in that sense. And I think it reflects some of the difficulties that that we have seen with getting things like complementary and alternative medicine incorporated into sort of conventional biomedicine.
Right, right. And in the beginning of the book, you spend some time talking about how this clinic is exceptional in some ways. In that it's, and I'm not sure if you meant just because of how integrated it was into these sort of community providers, or if that was because of the unique perspective of Dr. Novak and her colleagues. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and how unique it was and how different it might have been from other pain practices around the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think this model where it's a clinic, but the where it's a team, but the members of the team are not actually hospital employees, that was the key difference. And it was often a bit of a surprise for families because they were sort of expecting that they would just go and their insurance would be accepted and it would sort of be all, you know, that seeing the hypnotherapist or seeing the family therapist would be a similar kind of charge as seeing the physician. So that was kind of the drawback. The advantage was that Dr. Novak had put together a team of people that she had kind of hand selected and were really outstanding, absolutely phenomenal clinicians. And so when it worked and when families were able to get their children seen by these clinicians, they were really able to sometimes make just a profound difference. Because they were quite gifted clinically. And also that the team kind of approach, I mean, I talk a little bit in the book about it working almost like a surrogate family. And there was this real sense of this whole team coming together to try to make things better for a patient and the patient's family. And even just that sense of caring and commitment on its own could be therapeutic. So I don't want to give the impression that that sort of what was exceptional about the clinic was bad or was, you know, that it only excluded people, because I think that there was a lot of good that came out of this model, but it had its limits at the same time.
Yeah. And I think also when I say exceptional or when we say exceptional, we also refer to particularity, right? And that has its own special spot in anthropology about paying attention to and tracing what's particular about things as well as universal to, say, a human experience. So you talk about when people reach this clinic in the first chapter, how they're reaching the quote bottom of the funnel. And that's the title of your first chapter after the introduction. And that's just one of the many metaphors. And I believe that's not your phrasing. That's the phrasing of Dr. Novak that they use. And in this chapter, you spend a good deal of time talking about and introducing these very vivid metaphors that the clinicians and the patients use to help make sense of pain. And there's a lot in these metaphors, as there always is. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about the importance of metaphors from the perspective of narrative in anthropology. And then maybe tell us a little bit about the metaphors themselves that they use.
Sure. I think metaphor has been studied from just a really broad range of fields as being really important to meaning making. And metaphor, I think, is really important to pain because pain escapes language. And or that's kind of the standard view anyway of pain, is that it's difficult to represent it and it's difficult to kind of escape the privacy of pain. And so metaphor can sort of provide another mode of representation when ordinary language escapes us. And I think that's really what I saw happening at the West Clinic. And I think that one of the values of metaphor that really came out in my fieldwork at the West Clinic is that metaphor can be quite persuasive as well, for sort of communicating an authoritative view of pain. Pain is ambiguous and it's uncertain and it's poorly understood, but when we can use metaphors to represent it, it seems a lot more legitimate and authoritative and scientific. So I guess, you know, the metaphors that I really address in that first chapter have to do with sort of neurochemical ways of thinking about pain. And Dr. Novak and also some of the other pediatric pain practitioners that I interviewed from other clinics had this way of talking about chronic pain as a software problem and not a hardware problem, and how chronic pain results from flaws in the neural signaling. And this was really, this kind of a way of thinking about pain in some ways was a corrective to older, more mechanical ways of thinking about pain. Pain is kind of caused by a broken body. So the physicians would say, you know, it's not that anything's broken, but there's a defect in the neural signaling. And I think using this neurobiological imagery really helped to give this chronic unexplained pain a sense of legitimacy and a sense that it's not all in your head. Like, this is a real biological problem. And the reason we haven't understood it thus far, the reason why all of the diagnostic tests have come back negative, is because we haven't been using the right tools, and we don't really have great tools for looking at your neural signaling.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons that metaphors are so powerful for anthropologists or other social scientists is that they do give us a window into larger social phenomena, historical phenomena. And I'm wondering, do you have a sense of when that mode changed from a more mechanical view of the body being broken to this more computer or network metaphor?
That's a good question. And I don't. I mean, I think I would have to do a little more research in order to answer that question. And it's been a little while since I've really been looking at the pain literature. It may have had something to do with the gate control theory of pain, but I forget exactly when that was introduced.
Yeah, no, it just occurred to me that maybe we take it for granted that computer metaphors have been with us for some time, but I'm just wondering, like, when it entered or maybe coexisted with older metaphors in formal pain literature. And that sort of gets to my second question in general, which is, you know, what are these metaphors sort of telling you about what's going on in a broader sense about how we're experiencing our bodies? That might be a really big question also.
It is, but, you know, I mean, I think that some of the metaphors are trying to get around mind-body dualism, right? And so, and I think that the kind of neurobiological language is a way of saying that the pain can be in your head, but not in a purely psychological sense. So that's not to say that the pain is kind of made up or unreal, but it's in your head because the head is kind of the seat of neurobiological functioning. And I think there's been a broader move in our society to want to adopt those neurobiological explanations. Mm-hmm.
What do you feel like they limit us, or how do you feel like they limit the folks in the pain clinic when using those metaphors? Because they clearly like open things up for patients and sort of get them out of the all in your head, quote unquote, paradigm. But I'm also wondering, like, how do they limit us and how we think about pain as well?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that they don't necessarily provide, they provide sort of a just-so story. I mean, they provide a plausible narrative, but it doesn't really resolve questions about responsibility and blame. I mean, we can still sort of blame ourselves for neurobiological problems. And I think that ultimately, the kind of treatment strategies that went along with these neurobiological metaphors still really relied heavily on individuals to do the work themselves and kind of take responsibility for their pain and their bodies and actively combat the pain. So they certainly didn't provide an easy out. And I think some families were looking for sort of an easy mechanical fix. So there was one family, for example, that left the clinic and ultimately got a neurostimulator device for their child because they wanted that sort of a mechanical fix.
Right. And a neurostimulator is sort of an implanted device. And was it in this case in the spinal cord? Yeah. That delivers like electronic messages that help to sort of in a broad sense, like confuse the brain in terms of signals that are coming in and lessen the sensations of pain. At least that's my vague understanding of it. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the sort of metaphorical tools that gets used a lot and which you get into in your second chapter is the idea of sort of smartness and the smart clinic. And I was wondering if you could describe that. Like what is the smart clinic? Like why is the clinic sort of dubbed the smart clinic? And how does that relate to these evolving ideas of pain, chronic pain, I should say?
So Dr. Novak called the West Clinic the Smart Clinic because she noticed over time that the patients that she tended to see in her clinic were smart, high achieving. They tended to excel in the arts or in sports or in various extracurricular pursuits. And so when they would come in and sort of she would, and all of her first appointments were 2 hours long. And so there would be quite a lot of time for the physicians to get to know the patients. And so they would begin to kind of describe what they were up to in junior high or high school. And she would say, well, you know, I call this the SMART clinic and you really fit that profile. And I think it was a way of, I became fascinated by this early on in my field work because it was so unexpected that there would be this constellation of traits that would hold these patients together. And as I came to do a little more research, I realized that actually it's maybe not historically unprecedented, and there have historically been sort of cases of behavioral or personality traits clustering around particular illness conditions. And I got interested in tracing some of that in the book. But I think part of what she was doing is she was trying to turn their pain into kind of a more positive experience and to say, you know, this is not, like, pain can be very morally loaded and people can be blamed. Chronic pain patients can be blamed. And she was sort of saying, like, actually, you have this because of something good about you and because of some really strong character attributes. And what I saw over time is it was true that many of the patients did fit the profile of the SMART patient, but I also saw that she would sometimes apply that label to patients that didn't quite fit. And so she was kind of using it rhetorically in a sense too. You know, even if it was a B student, which by today's standards due to grade inflation is not necessarily a particularly brilliant student, but she would kind of still say, oh, and you know, you're so smart and this is the SMART clinic. So it was interesting how it, I think it was both an accurate representation and something of a more pragmatic tool.
Mm-hmm. And is that what you mean? Is that what you meant by personhood diagnostics, that term that you talked about in that chapter?
Yeah, I introduced that term to talk about the ways that personality traits become folded into understandings of illness and sort of how she would mobilize their smartness and their achievement in both her diagnostic explanation, but then also in her therapeutic plan for how those skills and strengths were going to help the child to overcome the pain.
Yeah. And if I read this correctly, it seemed like that was all still tied to these like neural network or computer metaphors for how the brain worked and how chronic pain was elaborated, because they, the smart kids, you know, quote unquote, were in some ways like very highly attuned to their environments or highly attuned to the world and just were very sensitive. And so they sort of provided a substrate for producing chronic pain. Is that correct in how she was sort of applying that metaphor?
Exactly. I mean, she talked about their neurons in a sense being too smart. So just as the child was smart in making connections and learning things easily, it was like the pain signals had become overdetermined because they were making connections really easily. And then pain was kind of getting entrenched because of those connections.
And that seemed really similar to the sticky brains phenomenon as well, right? I mean, and, which is your third chapter. And so can you tell us a little bit about sticky brains? And I'm really interested in the PDD, which now I'm completely forgetting the what that stands for, the pervasive developmental disorder. That's it. The PDD and the PDD-ish, and how that is, how also your perspective on that now that that's sort of fallen out of the latest DSM. So can you explain that a little bit? Sorry, there's a lot in there, but it's all related.
So the PDD, so this idea of sticky brain was a metaphor that was used to describe a subset of the clinic's patients whom were believed to show signs of a pervasive developmental disorder. And they use that category kind of broadly in the sense, so PDD used to be one of the five disorders that was on the autism spectrum. And they used it in kind of a broad sense to refer to characteristics of kids that we might think of as falling on the high functioning end of the autism spectrum. And they weren't really using it in a like strictly DSM sense, but they were using it as kind of a heuristic to talk about kids that shared some characteristics with patients that we might think about as having high functioning autism. So sensitivity to light, or you know, perseveration on particular ideas, things like that. But they also found that in those kids, treatment was often very difficult, and it was sometimes really difficult to get these kids to improve. And so they had this explanatory model that tied the difficulties they experienced in treatment to the fact that they had so-called sticky brains. And so the neurons were not only smart, but they were also sticky, and it was really difficult to kind of rewire the neural circuitry because of that.
I'm wondering, you know, for those kids, did they seem to be pretty refractory even to like this clinic's interventions?
A lot of them did. A lot of them did. I mean, I did see some improvement with some of them. So the what's interesting is the child that I talk about a lot in chapter two, Michael Harris, who is prototypical smart kid, like he was one that they actually talked about as being PDD-ish behind the scenes, sort of. I talk about it as the clinic's backstage. So they would talk about him in that way in the team meetings, but never mentioned it to the family. And he did get better. You know, I think he's a kid that probably continued to struggle, but there were improvements. So it wasn't impossible, but I think it was often the case that the PDD label kind of seemed to attach to kids that just weren't doing well in treatment. So we can ask really, is it about the kid or is it kind of about the therapeutic trajectory? And sometimes that's got blurred.
And I'm now even just noticing like the language I was even using to describe the patients where I said the patient was refractory to treatment. I was kind of like putting the blame on him. So can you tell us a little bit more about Michael actually? What brought him to the clinic and describe what his pain was?
So he was one of the younger kids that I wrote about. He was only, I think, 12 at the time that I did this work. And he had a pretty typical pain complaint for a kid in this clinic. He had chronic abdominal pain. He had been worked up by GI and I think probably worked up by other specialties as well. And they couldn't find anything organically wrong with him. So, you know, this is a kid that would typically be diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. And that's what Dr. Novak ultimately did diagnose him with, but she had a way of turning that into a much more kind of credible and legitimate sounding diagnosis than it might sound like if you got that diagnosis from a gastroenterologist. So when Michael came to the clinic, he was out of school. His parents were just completely beside themselves. And he did very well with treatment, some of which was pharmaceutical, but a lot of which was hypnotherapy. And he was able to kind of buy into this paradigm of rewiring his neural circuitry through hypnotherapy. And it was pretty cool to see, especially because he sort of went into it with this attitude of being really skeptical about that kind of an approach.
Oh, yeah, that is quite young. And so he was one of these also really smart kids, or he seemed like pretty precocious. And in the interview excerpts, I really did see how the physician would appeal to that part of him, right? That you know, that this gift that he had being so smart and precocious was also sort of a risk factor, I guess, for why he was experiencing all this pain. And I think throughout the book, but especially as you get to the chapters about at the end about family and then the social context, you really see how there's this awkward dance between the individual and like what's in the individual and within the power of the individual and requiring their autonomy and willpower, I guess, and to fix themselves and the outside context, which is to blame. And like basically locating pain, just the difficulty of locating pain. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that with regards to the family, with regards to families and with regards to the social context, maybe starting with the family.
Yeah, I mean, that I think is part of what makes the treatment of pediatric pain so complicated and probably much more complicated than treating adult pain, even in the current opioid crisis, which is just that you're having to treat the child, but the child's pain is shaped so much in response to what's going on in the family. And you're often very powerless to treat the family dynamics. I mean, some families are open to the idea that that family dynamics are implicated in the management of pain, if not in kind of the genesis of pain. But many families become very defensive when that is raised as a factor, and they think that it is sort of a brush off and like a thing, you know, the pain isn't real, we're going to focus on the family dynamics. So it just becomes really difficult for clinicians to manage that. And I think many feel like you can only go so far just focusing on the patient. And so I think that sort of careful orchestration between family and child is one of the things that I found really, really fascinating about working in this context. So hard to kind of get right, even with well-meaning, really compassionate, empathic clinicians. There are just so many ways in which one can kind of go be led astray.
Yeah. And I imagine there are some families who are going to be amenable to opening up the family as a site of therapeutic intervention, and then others who, like you said, are going to shut down or feel that the blame is being put on them. And I was wondering if you could tell us about one family that you highlighted, the Joffeys. Is that how you say their name, or the Joffs?
Sure. We can say Joffe. I mean, it's a pseudonym.
It's a pseudonym. Okay.
So that was another one of these longitudinal case studies that I followed really intensively along with Michael Harris. Claire was a fascinating person. She was really talented. She wasn't necessarily academically gifted, but she was really gifted at drawing and art, and she was also really gifted at sports. And it's a little bit unusual to see that combination together. She started with back pain. And so she had been through a series of workups with orthopedists and neurologists and sort of onward from there. And then soon after she came to the clinic, and I did meet her just before her first appointment in the clinic. And then I think actually maybe the night before her first clinic appointment, she had a pseudo seizure. And she started to have these episodes of completely blacking out and having these pseudo seizures. And she was taken to the hospital by paramedics a couple of times. So it was a very distressing time for her family. And the clinicians in the West Clinic were also quite worried about her. I mean, she had... For a little while, she had weekly appointments there, which was a bit unusual, as they were trying to get a handle of what was going on. And so they kind of cycled through a variety of different explanations for her pain as they were trying to make sense of these symptoms that really crop up a lot when we think about these older illness conditions like hysteria. Things that like Freud wrote about. So, you know, initially they gave her the very same kind of personhood diagnostic sort of spiel, and they talked about her neural signaling. But then they became a little bit more interested in family dynamics as a site of tension and possibly contributing to the pain, like especially after she developed these pseudo seizures and that they were hard to control. And then there was this, her family was put in a very difficult position because of the pseudo seizures, Claire, they were afraid of leaving her alone. So they started sleeping next to her on the floor on a mattress because she had done some injurious behavior to herself in the midst of one of these seizures. They were afraid of having to go to the bathroom by herself. So then the team started talking about, you know, their concerns that this watchfulness was not appropriate for a 14-year-old girl, and that she needed to have a bit more space, especially from her father. There were some gender ways of kind of looking at this dynamic as well. So, you know, that was a case that was really baffling and troubling, and ultimately she got better. But there was a sense that no one ever had a very clear explanation for what happened with her.
Right, right. I mean, she's one example also where she exceeded the metaphors in some ways.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the medical part of me is really, really curious if she ever got like a more specific diagnosis. Reading her story, I just couldn't help. I mean, there's the anthropology in me reading it, and then the almost physician in me reading it is thinking like, oh, but did they get an answer? Was there a diagnosis? And I'm curious, did they ever sort of clarify what was going on?
No, I mean, I don't think they ever got any more of a diagnosis than what was given to her in the West Clinic. And I saw her, I think a year, maybe more after I finished the study, and she was doing really well. And, you know, had moved on from this period. So I didn't get the sense that there was an ongoing diagnostic odyssey or anything like that.
Oh, interesting. And so did you feel that addressing the family issues was what really helped her? Or was it just a combination of all
the
things?
It's hard to know, right? I mean, it's one of those things where it's really hard to know what it was that helped her. I think one thing that helped her more than anything was having this really supportive team who cared about her a lot. I really think a lot of the family issues were sort of a red herring, and I'm not sure much of what was concerning came out only in the context of managing what was sort of an acute situation, right? So I mean, who knows? It's really hard to know what's going on with these families, but I was never convinced that there was strong evidence for more enduring family pathology.
Right, right. So how did the clinic deal with the more social locations of pain, like the school stressors and those?
Yeah, I mean, school came up a lot because a lot of these kids came to clinic having stopped going to school. And some of them were enrolled in homeschool programs. Some of them had just kind of stopped going because they were in too much pain. And so the goal was always to try to get them back into school. And they had a child and family therapist that was really good at this. And she would talk to a lot of the schools, and she would, you know, at first often try to get kids to go back just for lunch period, not even doing anything academically, but just to try to reintegrate them socially into their peer groups. There was a lot of discussion about the pressures on adolescents today and, you know, this sense that some of this pain was at more of this societal level happening because kids today are under so much pressure to excel, and they're thinking about college. And a lot of this has to do with the particular socioeconomic demographic that I'm talking about in this clinic. They're very concerned about chances for future success, and that sort of getting into a good college is important for that. So there were lots of discussions in the team meetings about these issues.
Yeah, and it made me think about what does social context mean to the clinic, you know? And I think about this all the time in medicine because we, and as you know, in a clinical encounter, you're one of the parts of the history that you take is the social history. And what a doctor thinks of as social is very different from what a social scientist or an anthropologist thinks of as social. And so I'm wondering if you thought about that vis-a-vis the clinic and what their view of the social was.
I think this particular clinic had a very rich understanding of the social. And I think part of that was because Dr. Novak, actually it's interesting, she had... I think when she was an undergraduate, she had gone to see Margaret Mead give a lecture and
got a PhD
for anthropology and ethnography. And she tried to incorporate that into her work. I mean, it's so rare to have a clinical setting where a priority is made to have a 2-hour intake appointment. And obviously obviously that model is not that sustainable. I think it was really important to her. I think also because there was an interdisciplinary team and you were getting multiple different providers' perspectives on a particular patient, that was really important to kind of having an enriched understanding of what the social context looks like. There were, like, for certain patients, they would open up more to certain providers on the team than others. And so I think, like, part of the context is not only what's happening in the patient's social world, but also what different kinds of information can be gleaned from the multiple perspectives of a multidisciplinary team where everyone's going to have a different relationship with this patient. And it's probably not going to be the physician that has the closest relationship.
I actually found that to be true also in other interdisciplinary settings that I've been in as a medical student. Where, yeah, I think, and maybe that's because, so in a psychiatric setting, like the physician is titrating medicines, whereas maybe the psychotherapist is the one who's engaging in psychodynamic therapy or CBT or something that involves more engaging with like the narrative of the person's life. And so sometimes when you get these multidisciplinary settings, the physician like practices at what I'm almost saying this pejoratively, but at the top of their license. I don't know if you've heard that term before, but it's this idea of in a healthcare setting, like the physician shouldn't be doing work that a nurse can do, or the physician shouldn't be doing the work that the PA or the triage nurse can do. They should be doing the thing that is like the most difficult at the top of their license. And the same thing with the nurse. The nurse should be doing what's at the top of their license. So sometimes in these interdisciplinary settings, I find that it might be efficient, and it probably is much more efficient, but I sometimes lament that the physician's role gets like cornered a bit. This is a little bit of a tangent, but it doesn't seem like that's what happened in this clinic. That is something that I feel that I've experienced. So I'm just looking at the time, and we're running low. But I have some broader questions for you about what you learned about pain writ large and from this clinic. And you know, we're living in the era of the opioid epidemic. Which is also a chronic pain epidemic. And I felt like that those two things were a bit like, they're almost like an elephant in the room for me reading this book. And I was wondering what this work taught you or could teach us about the broader, like addressing the broader situation that we're in with pain and opioids.
Well, you know, it's interesting because The first project that I pursued when I came to UNC to start my faculty position was a study of communication about opioids in the emergency department. And part of the reason why I wanted to do that study is because I felt like what I had gotten from this work in the West Clinic was just a slice of what pain management is like for kind of a small sliver of society, and I really wanted to understand what it's like for a much broader segment of society. And I felt like to do that, I had to go to the emergency department because that's where, unfortunately, a lot of people in this country get their pain treatment. And so, you know, that didn't turn out to be a huge project for a variety of reasons, but I did a little bit of work there and wrote a couple of papers. And one thing that I learned is that it wasn't kind of all about getting the pain meds, at least for the patients in this particular ED that I was working on, that they were often given meds because there was so much else that they lacked. They lacked a primary care physician. They lacked like basic healthcare resources, and opioids were given because it was just the only thing that could be given in that setting. And so I guess the way, I mean, that's sort of a roundabout way of answering your question, but I think that what I learned is that what patients who have chronic pain really need a variety of kinds of tools to deal with it. And even with all the different services that the West Clinic had available, it was rarely kind of an easy fix, but that a lot of patients could get somewhat better with those tools. So I think in terms of understanding what that has to say about the opioid epidemic, I think the issue is that we've been focused on kind of combating the problems with these medications and not sort of looking again at context and sort of at the broader social and structural context of people's lives that has led to this crisis. And so I think that, yeah, I mean, I think that if we had better tools for treating chronic pain, then we might not be in the situation that we're in. And if we could get multidisciplinary treatments reimbursed and funded, we might not be in the situation that we're in. But also, like, if we had just kind of basic healthcare, universal healthcare, and like dealt with poverty and other things, then, you know, we can sort of see how all these things go together.
Right. And not just the medication, that's this substitution for care, you know, this like symbolic substitution for care. Well, I see we're running out of time, but if we have a couple more minutes, maybe you can just really quickly tell us what you're working on next.
Sure. I am about to start writing a book about physician aid in dying or physician assisted suicide. I have just wrapped up about 2 years of fieldwork looking at the implementation of Vermont's aid in dying law. And I have spent the past couple of summers and some additional time interviewing physicians and nurses and family caregivers and patients and also activists and policy stakeholders about their perspectives on the law and their experiences with it. And I'm really, it's been an incredible project. It references pain a lot, more than maybe I expected, but also I'm seeing how kind of the family and social context of care for the dying is really integral in a way that harkens back to my work on All in Your Head as well. So I will be, I've been kind of working on analyzing the data, and I'm going to be getting started on writing a book about this project over the summer.
That sounds really exciting and really important work. Thank you so much, Mara, for your time. It was really generous, and I really enjoyed reading your book, and it's really helped me think about the chronic pain patients that I've seen, and I'm excited to sort of use some of your insights as I become a pediatrician. Well, thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and inspired you to read on. I think in the midst of this opioid epidemic, so much talk is around the drugs. But what's clear is that we got here by fundamentally misunderstanding and mistreating the pain. And I think we need a cultural and social reckoning with pain, how it's socially embedded and shaped, the power we give it, how we explain it, and ultimately how we treat it. Professor Bookbinder's work is a great starting point for that. And I think what she shows is that in pediatrics, we're already primed to consider the entire family and social context of a child as is part of their suffering and their potential healing. And right now, I'm currently rotating through an adult pain clinic. And while they provide great care and think about their patients holistically, it's definitely still narrowly focused on that individual sitting in front of them. And I think until we can widen that lens for every patient, not just in the clinic, but thinking outside of the clinic, we're not really going to get to the bottom of this problem. Anyway, I'm excited to continue to follow her work. And thanks for listening, all. And as always, I welcome your reactions, thoughts, and feedback. You can find me on Twitter @DanaGfield and @NewBooksMed. Bye.